Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The world is on the verge of a revolution, and this is a good thing, says Lester Brown at World Watch Institute. In his annual State of the World report, he says the environmental revolution will be quicker and more critical than any that has swept human civilization. Also this time, the New England Tropical Conservatory, the first stage of a plan to reactivate the nation's military bases and preserve biodiversity. And this.
Alda Leopold was more than just a forester or more than just a wildlife game manager. He really was the philosopher behind the modern American preservation movement.
A conversation with film producer Larry Hott. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. In his poem, The Road Not Taken, Robert Frost concludes thus. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. We are at such a crossroads, says Lester Brown, president of World Watch Institute. In his annual State of the World report, Brown writes of our present dilemma and challenge. Quote, our choice now is either to rally behind the environmental revolution or continue on the current path.
If we're going to achieve the kinds of changes that are needed, we're really talking about an environmental revolution. We're talking about restructuring the global energy economy. We're talking about a revolution in human reproductive behavior that's needed to stabilize population. And this is a revolution on an enormous scale. It's an economic and social transformation that probably ranks with the agricultural revolution and the industrial revolution. With the agricultural revolution, the stage was set for enormous population growth, dramatic demographic changes. The same will be true for the environmental revolution in the sense that it will set the stage for dramatic changes, but the changes will be in slowing and stabilizing population growth rather than in accelerating it. The Industrial Revolution was based on a shift to fossil fuels. The Environmental Revolution, if it succeeds, will be based on a shift away from fossil fuels. So we're talking about some rather fundamental shifts, and shifts that have to occur in a short period of time.
Each year since 1983, Brown has led a research writing team in an expansive review, analysis, and forecast of the environmental state of the world. The report is generally a composite of shocking realities and hopeful prescriptions. Leading to the publication this year, Brown says World Watch compiled a list of critical indicators.
We're seeing more and more evidence, I think. I've noticed that this year, perhaps more than before, evidence that the environmental degradation of the planet is beginning to take a social and economic toll. We see it in its effect on human health, whether it's the thousands of 10-year-olds that live in the Los Angeles basin that have permanently impaired respiratory systems just because they breathe the air there, or the 300,000 people in the Soviet Union who are now being treated for radiation sickness, or the soaring cancer rates in Eastern Europe, or the EPA estimates that 200,000 Americans will die of skin cancer fatalities because of the increase in stratospheric ozone depletion over the last decade or so. We see the growth in world food output slowing, in part for environmental reasons, soil erosion, air pollution, acid rain, hotter summers, and also probably because of stratospheric ozone depletion. There's now some substantial research getting underway, some in this country, some in Australia, some at the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, looking at the effects of stratospheric ozone depletion and the resulting increase in ultraviolet radiation reaching the Earth's surface and how it's affecting crops. And we're beginning to see that it does indeed have an effect, and the effects are negative.
These are the signs of the times, times, Brown says, that are ripe for revolution. But what will it be like, this revolution?
the kind of world that will sustain progress and improvements in the human condition is one that will be powered by solar energy in its many forms, and we now have the technologies to efficiently harness solar energy. It'll be a world in which small families prevail. It'll be a world in which we reuse and recycle containers and materials of all kinds. The throwaway society will shortly become history. It's a world in which the relationship between ourselves, however many billion of us there will be, probably not more than eight, and the natural systems and resources on which we depend will have stabilized. Right now, we're part of a highly unstable relationship with life support systems deteriorating rapidly in many parts of the world.
Brown says the conditions warrant change one way or the other, even if we decide not to decide to take action. That in itself would be a change. But, says Brown, do we lead the change or will we follow it?
Change is often threatening. Most of us resist change. There's a certain amount of inertia, both in human behavior at the individual level and certainly in society and in social institutions. It's not going to be an easy thing, but the thing we have to realize is that if we're going to build a sustainable future, we all have to get involved. It's not something that a handful of environmentalists can do while the rest of the world looks on. I think I use the example of a sporting event. The existing situation is rather like a sporting event where there are thousands of people sitting in the stands watching the contest being decided on the field. And it seems to me we need to erase those sidelines between the spectators and the participants so we can all become participants in the battle to save the planet, as it were.
Here are some other observations in the publication this year. 140 plant and animal species die out, extinct, each day. The atmosphere now contains 26% more carbon dioxide than before the Industrial Revolution. Six of the hottest years since record-keeping began have been observed since 1980. 92 million more people are added to the world's audience each year, the size of Mexico. Having observed the world's affairs in this way for 9 years now, Brown puts this year in context.
Well, if we look at the state of the world as a doctor would look at the condition of a patient and checking its vital signs, we have to admit that we have not turned around a single major trend of global environmental degradation over the last 9 years. The forests are still shrinking, the deserts are expanding, the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is still rising. We're losing plant and animal species at record rates. We're losing billions of tons of topsoil from our cropland each year, and so forth. The exciting thing is that the Cold War is now over. The Soviet Union no longer exists. And we have an opportunity to rethink entirely the definition of security that guides the expenditure of public funds.
Brown suggests we think of security not in military terms now, but as environmental stability. In this context, Brown sees the upcoming United Nations conference in Rio de Janeiro in June as the equivalent of a military NATO-type summit. Lester Brown is president of World Watch Institute and a frequent guest on the Environment Show. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. And this is Bruce Robertson. What might be the best use of a closed military base? What might be the best way to preserve biological diversity? What might be the best way to get a look at some of the Earth's rare, disappearing plants, seeds and spores, tubers and roots? The answer: a tropical conservatory. The idea is the work of Scott Hoover. The botanist is proposing the first such to be located somewhere in his native western Massachusetts. He would call it the New England Tropical Conservatory.
Clearly, the magic of this project is its ability to integrate biodiversity preservation with economic development and education. Under most circumstances, biodiversity preservation is holding the natural rainforest lands of the world in a way so they remain completely untouched. But unfortunately, deforestation is proceeding at such a rapid rate that we're losing upwards to around 75,000 to 80,000 square miles a year. Our project is proposing to go in and at least collect the species, the live plant material, from those rainforests, hold them in the native countries, and then as well at some point for safekeeping, bring them back, bring that germplasm back into the United States and hold it in facilities, different facilities scattered around the United States. So this is ultimately a national project, even though our administrative and managing center would be in western Massachusetts. And the reason why we would stay in Massachusetts as its center is because Massachusetts is the education state. A fantastic resource of the state of Massachusetts are its academic institutions. They have among the finest in the country. And for that reason alone is why this project should stay in this state. But aside from that, we don't want to hold all this tropical germplasm here in this state. We want to scatter it out in different facilities around the country.
One of the ideas Hoover proposes is to make use of some of the military bases slated for closure in the wake of Defense Department budget cutbacks.
So you have set infrastructures already established there. You have buildings, you have water, you have plumbing, you have all kinds of facilities, you have roadworks, and as a concept, if we could select out several of these bases at certain points around the country, a particular military base could be a conservatory, a greenhouse, that could contain the germplasm, the live plant material from a particular tropical country. And each particular facility around the United States could house the plant germplasm from another country. And in that way, that particular town or city, wherever the base military installation is, would not experience the dramatic dissension of its economic base. We would provide the impetus for a tourist economy to come in and then develop, so all the small shops and the restaurants and everything could all continue to survive.
Before there could be many, there would be one such conservatory, says Hoover, to be located somewhere in western Massachusetts. Architectural designs to form the building in the shape of a nautilus, the spiraled seashell, have already been drawn in detail by Scott Guyon, president of Guyon Architects in Lexington, Kentucky. Hoover says the 58,000-square-foot facility would be unlike anything you have ever seen, incorporating giant aerial gardens.
We would create these gigantic artificial trees, and then out in the branches of the trees, you would build these planters. So you have live plant material in these huge trees that are upwards to 85 feet tall, and then run catwalks through them at their various heights. And in that way, you resolve the problem that most conservatories face, which is having this landscaped foundation area, a flat surface, your ground area, and then you have a tremendous gap between that and the ceiling. What we're talking about is literally filling the entire volumetric space of this conservatory with vegetation. So the visitor no longer participates and experiences just a two-dimensional surface. He experiences an entire three-dimensional surface.
While it may seem incongruous to site a tropical habitat in some northern climate, Hoover says engineers have long since solved temperature and humidity control problems that otherwise would prevent such a venture. In fact, one of the world's largest gardens under glass is the Montreal Botanic Garden in Montreal, Canada. Hoover says the New England Tropical Conservatory would be even more finely adjusted to specific projects.
What our plan would be to, at each of these facilities, scattered around the United States, what you would do at each one of these is you would divide up the facility into three separate habitats and environments, climatic regimes. And in that way, you could accommodate the diversity of all the plants that you would collect from any given country. At least they could fit in very likely into one of the three climatic regimes you would create. And in that way, you resolve that problem of not having an environment that would be hospitable to the plants. After all, for people have been importing plants into this country and especially into Britain for probably 500 or 600 years, with a major thrust during the 1800s of bringing in hundreds and hundreds of plants. But it's interesting to note that of the estimated 600 to 750,000 species of plants in the world, only about 5% or less have ever been introduced to cultivation. So you have this enormous situation out there, enormous numbers of species of plants that have never been brought into cultivation. And rates of extinction are proceeding very dramatically. And it's not that our project is based solely on biodiversity preservation to thwart extinction. It's what the application of bringing those plants into cultivation in the first place has to do. I mean, there's just enormous possibilities, not only from the tourist standpoint, but from a research standpoint, from a pharmaceutical standpoint, from an agricultural standpoint. There's many, many applications that are available to do with the plants once they are in cultivation.
The plan, says Hoover, is to develop first a network of small regional conservatories in various tropical countries. These facilities would provide the botanical specimens a refuge in their natural habitats. Hoover and his associates, working in Ecuador on the first stage of such a system, would employ local people to collect the samples. Taking advantage of existing temperature and humidity conditions as well, Hoover estimates such a conservatory might be constructed for around $4 million. Scott Hoover, botanist and landscape designer, is founder and creator of the New England Tropical Conservatory, the first of this multinational network. At this point, he says, NETC is looking to raise $400,000 to conduct a feasibility study upon which the rest of the project would be determined. This is Bruce Robertson. One of the most significant writings in environmental literature is A Sand County Almanac, written by Aldo Leopold, where these words we read: "No important change in ethics was ever accomplished without an internal change in our intellectual emphasis, loyalties, affections, and convictions."
Aldo Leopold was more than just a forester or more than just a wildlife game manager. He really was the philosopher behind the modern American preservation movement.
Film producer Larry Hott.
In fact, behind all of the environmental movement, we wouldn't have a strong movement today if it hadn't been for Leopold's thinking. He's the person who spurred on the movers and shakers of the 50s and 60s to make the environmental movement what it was. What he did is he took two very polarized ways of looking at the world, a kind of humanities approach to it and a scientific approach to it, and he brought those things together, and he made the link between a spiritual way or a intellectual or a way of looking at the world and an ecological way, but I mean ecologically scientific, in a scientific way. He was able to put together those two concepts and make it work as a rationale for saving wild lands, in fact, for saving just about everything. And that's what his true importance is he's the first person who combines the two schools of thought, the scientific and the humanistic, in one rationale for preservation.
Hott's latest film, Wild by Law, soon to be released on PBS, will trace the life and the accomplishments of Leopold and two other significant leaders of the wilderness movement, Lewis Marshall and Howard Zonizer. Marshall founded the Wilderness Society and it was largely through the lobbying efforts of Howard Zonheiser that the Wilderness Act became law in 1964. Again, Larry Hutt.
Well, Zonheiser was responsible because of his personal energy, but it's likely that he could not have done it without Marshall and Leopold before him. You know, the wilderness movement or the environmental movement has its three prophets, and they are Marshall, Leopold, and Zonheiser. Leopold is the philosopher. He's the one who gives it its rationale. And Marshall is the one who gives it its energy. He's the activist. But those two really couldn't have gotten anywhere without somebody coming along as a bureaucrat and politician, and that is Zonheiser. So you really have this triumvirate, this holy trinity of the wilderness movement. So even though maybe it would have fallen apart with any one of them, the three of them together, living at separate times, are what pushed the wilderness movement forward. We don't have anybody like those three now. We have very good, high-energy people, but many of them are MBAs, they're lawyers, they're people in government. But the kind of activists and philosophers and infighting pitbull-type bureaucrats like Zonheiser, they're not around, and we don't have the kind of environmental heroes that we had in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Though the struggle over the preservation of wilderness areas continues today, Hutt suggests that we as a nation really have come a long way.
There are very few people, industrialists, government people, Forest Service people, who would not call themselves at least a conservationist. In the end of the 19th century, through the middle of the 20th century, many people didn't know what the word meant, let alone believe in it. But now, to say that you're not a conservationist is tantamount to saying that you're a fascist or a Bolshevik, or, you know, you just don't admit it anymore. So that has changed. People, if you talk to anybody in the extractive industries, by that I mean the timber industries or the mining industries, they will always tell you that they believe in wilderness preservation, that they are environmentalists themselves. Even George Bush says he's the environmental president. But what they talk about is a matter of degree, how far we should go.
What really is at issue today, even as it was 50 years ago, is not what do we make of the vast tracts of wild territory. The issue is what is our place in the landscape. And, says Hutt, in this way, Leopold, from his farm in Wisconsin, wrote with profound insight.
And one of the reasons that Leopold is such a prophet and that his San Canty Almanac is really a true Bible for the movement is that he is talking about things other than just these millions and millions of acres that we set aside as these pristine wilderness areas. He's talking about how you manage your 50 by 100-foot lot, which is something that prefigures the whole recycling movement that gives when he's writing about it in the 1930s and 40s, he's prescient. He looks into the future and he sees where the country is going and sees unless each individual takes responsibility for the health of the land around him, then the United States, and in fact the world, is doomed, because it has to be the individual initiative, and the individual also has to understand where they are in the scheme of things. That's what the land ethic is, that we spent millennia putting ourselves at the top of the pyramid and thereby ignoring everything that's below us. And if you continue to do that on a personal level, well, then eventually you're digging your own grave in an almost a literal way.
Larry Hutt, co-producer with his wife, Diane Gary, of Wild by Law, The Redefinition of American Progress, detailing the preservation efforts of Aldo Leopold, Louis Marshall, and Howard Zonheiser.
My favorite Leopold quote is very short. It's just, he said this in 1941, at the beginning of the war, "If science cannot lead us to wisdom as well as power, it is surely no science at all."
The documentary, 8 years in the Making, will air nationally on public television Monday, January 27th, part of the American Experience series. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our report on the Environment Show for this week. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Be sure to ask for the Environment Show this week, number 107. That's 1-800-767-1929, The Environment Show, number 107. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.